This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions come face-to-face with business decisions. Online at www.bgov.com and, of course, on the air right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, where in my hands I have, you hear it, in my hands, news and analysis from BGov. Congress seizes reins with $30 billion defense cut. It's a BGov Insight. Joining me are two of the three authors, Dr. Kevin Brancato and, of course, Robert Levinson. Gentlemen, how are you?
Excellent.
Very good.
Great. Enjoying the weather.
Lovely, and lovely weather it is, Rob. So this just, as I'm reading this, it lends itself the question, wow, there's how many other separate bank accounts are there that are sequestered from money that can't be touched by other people that are, you know what I mean? This is getting kind of interesting for me as this discusses the more than 100 million military acquisition programs provided money, more money than the president actually requested because it was taken from here and there and that kind of thing. Rob, walk me through this process, if you would.
Well, I mean, as you know, Alan, the basic process is the president submits, you know, his what he call his budget request for the entire government, not just defense. Normally in February, this past one for this fiscal year, February 14, was a bit late because of the whole sequester business and sorting all of that out for 13. In 13, they took these automatic across the board sequester cuts. This time, you know, eventually there was this budget agreement between Senator Murray for the Democrats and Mr. Ryan in the House for the Republicans, and they agreed to these lower levels of spending, which weren't quite as low as the sequester would have taken them, but still significantly lower than the president's request. The difference is this time around, Congress actually had to sort of decide how to make these cuts. It wasn't this across-the-board sort of automated mechanism. And so what we see here now is the result of, you know, the Congress making the decisions ultimately about where those cuts are going to be. Now, normally, in a normal year, there might be a back and forth between the president and the Congress. But in this case, basically, the president just signed the bill sort of as is from the Congress because they had already agreed to sort of the top-line levels.
Which is better, Kevin? We look at a sequester where it's just across-the-board cut, or something where Congress goes in and just dilly-dallies, I'm going to put some money here, I'm going to put some money there.
No, it's like an open check. No, you're thinking about this wrong.
All right.
Well, I mean, one argument could say that the sequester actually worked, right? So the whole point is, if Congress, you can't come to an agreement. That's what sequester was about. You can't come to an agreement, find out where the money's supposed to come from. We're going to take it from you. We're just going to take it from you automatically. Well, at this point, Congress identified particular programs that it wanted to cut and programs that it thought it needed more funding. Now, it's not obvious why some of these decreases or increases were made. We've looked through the reports, and the rationales are mostly extraordinarily vague. Program increase, program decrease. And so you don't have a good sense about what went on in Congress, how they did this, how they interacted with the Pentagon, how they interacted with other parts of the government. So it's not just the idea that, oh, earmarks went away, so Congress wants to add money to pet projects. No.
Ding, 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 ding,
no,
ding.
I know.
That's exactly where I was going.
You really want to be able to say this.
Right.
Be a great, but a lot of the programs, huge programs, took cuts, programs of extreme congressional interest. So they had to make real priorities. And this is not, of course, Congress itself. It's all the staff, the professional staff, and the congressman staff eventually, that contribute to these decisions. But it's not possible to really pinpoint and go in and say, oh, these 100 programs got money, so these are the ones they really, really care about. I don't want to go there. I don't think that's the right way to think about this, because they had to take large cuts based, as Rob said, on the agreement. The agreement was, this is the amount of money we have to spend on it. Choose.
Well, they made the decisions on where the money would come from. Was this a collective? We don't know who they spoke to. We weren't in the rooms when these decisions were made, so one can only think that some of the decisions that were made were political in nature.
Alan, I mean, that's of course true. I mean, some of the decisions, as they are every year, some of the decisions are going to be made on what you would call a more political interest. In other words, a member was probably trying to protect something in his district, some work that was being done in his district, and some member worked really hard to protect that, perhaps contrary to the desires of the Pentagon, which might have wanted to cut that program. But then others of it is, you know, legitimate sort of disagreements between the Congress and the Pentagon. I mean, Congress gets to make the call on these things, and they disagree with the Pentagon about the prioritization that the Pentagon is making on some program and says, no, we're going to move more money over to this program. You know, they move more money, for example, into submarines. Nobody thinks that the submarines aren't a priority. Now, could there have been motivation by members of Congress where the submarines are made in Connecticut? Sure, there could have been. But, again, it's very hard to unpack all of that. And so there's a combination of motives going on here. It's a little harder to see, as we mentioned, with the age of earmarks, real strict earmarks going away. It's really, really hard to sort of nail these down as saying this was purely a political move. And as Kevin said, you know, they had to cut a lot, and they ultimately did.
Yeah, and they had to cut, and you have to go where the money is, right? And so the Air Force had said repeatedly, the F-35 is our priority. The F-35 is our priority. What's one of the largest cuts they took?
Yeah.
To the F-35. Now, of course, because that's where a huge amount of the money is. So they took money in research and development, and they took money in procurement from Lockheed Martin's F-35 program. But they didn't take the number of planes and trim that down for this fiscal year. They didn't cut that down. So they're going to keep the number of planes that they wanted to buy, and they've cut back in other areas, even some development programs and other areas of funding. So you say, well, wait a minute, so that was just money for the taking? Well, not really. I think there are other parts of engineering improvement and other areas where the cuts will have effect, but they don't have effect in the priorities. They say they need the aircraft,
right?
And that's what they're going to get. Now, they did cut some aircraft for next year. They took some of the advanced procurement funding they have to have early for titanium and other sorts of stuff, and they cut that. But, I mean, that's one clear explanation where priorities are stated and clear, and they took money anyway.
We're looking at $477 million, or 7.5% of the Pentagon's request for the aircraft, the F-35. Now, I'm guessing they'll
just the procurement side,
right, just the procurement. I'm guessing they'll just leave radar or something insignificant out of it.
You know, well, no, it doesn't have to fly.
It doesn't have to fly. But this is something that they've already stated. It can be a money-making proposition, this F-35. Other countries are in the business of buying this. Why cut so much money out of a program that could make money for the government and for all the defense contractors involved?
Well, it's not going to decrease the capability of the jets. What I think is going to happen is they're going to decrease, at least on the R&D side,
right,
the injection of new capabilities over time, so they could change the schedule. They have a huge software problem on the F-35.
Right.
They've threw a lot of money at it to make it work. But the inner workings of this program are not very well detailed. I've had a Freedom of Information Act request, which has been, I made 3 years ago, for the details of this program. And now they've kept me updated and said that this, but there is so much going on in this program that it is this constant churn that it's expected that you're not going to be able to understand what's going on. And different programs have different excuses to why. But the EELV program, for example.
I was just about to go there next.
Yes, the United Launch Alliance, which is Lockheed Martin and Boeing. Now, there's this huge cut from it, yet they didn't trim back the number of launches. This is, you'll find it in Air Force, I think, missile procurement, because it's a rocket. It launches satellites into space. And these are the big rockets. These are the ones that are used. But the Air Force uses, and the National Reconnaissance Office uses to launch classified satellites. But they didn't cut money for launches. And so it looks like they just cut money left and right, sustainment and support and whatever. And is this going to decrease the reliability? Is this going to do what? Well, you hear a very different story when you talk to United Launch Alliance themselves. And they say, last year we signed an agreement. We signed an agreement with the government that let them make this cut. We agreed that our prices had risen and that we were able to find a way using a long-term agreement to cut back the amount of money that the government needs to spend. So what they're saying is, no, industry should take some credit for the ability of the government to make these reductions. Don't ding the program, don't ding the company. It is a win-win as far as they're concerned. And that's a very different type of story.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, where my guests are Dr. Kevin Brancato and Robert Levinson, both senior defense analysts with Bloomberg Government. Congress seizes reins with 30 million defense cuts, a BGov insight. You look at this chart, it's clear, the chart included here, operations and maintenance is one of the big things. However, operations, overseas contingency operations, the account that I kind of alluded to at the beginning of the program, is something that is kind of, how was it put here? A separate ledger not subject to the spending caps mandated by the budget statement. Why add more money, Rob, to this particular account when we're looking at drawing back troops in Afghanistan? Why? What's the purpose of putting more money over there?
Yeah, well, Alan, this is really a way that Congress, this is a little bit of a budget gimmickry, because as we say, the Overseas Contingency Operation, or OCO as it's commonly called, account doesn't count against the caps that have been set in the Budget Control Act and were then sort of adjusted by the Ryan Murray Agreement. That money doesn't count. So you see that what Congress did, they cut money out of the O&M accounts in the base budget, which does count against the caps, and that left more room for, say, procurement and RD&T&E, but then they added money back in, basically, in the OCO account, which doesn't count. Now, whether or not they're going to be able to use all that money in the OCO account, it's probably very unlikely, particularly as the way things are going with the negotiations with the Afghans. We may be out of there very fast. And then they would have to sort of just reprogram this money. But basically, they were taking some latitude because the OCO account is not counted against the caps. It's sort of, I mean, a pejorative term might be a slush fund. I think that's a little bit extreme. But basically, they could take money out of the base budget and stick it back in the OCO account and leave room in the base budget for other stuff that they wanted to fund.
So this is more of a, like, we're going to do what we want with this, and you can't stop us kind of deal, and then we'll pull it out when we're ready.
Yeah, and Rob's right about, I mean, we pull out early from Afghanistan. Now, operation and military personnel funding, just a little part of that. That gets spent right away. But operation and maintenance spending doesn't get expended immediately in the first year. There's some procurement in there, too, and that doesn't get expended for a long time. But the operation and maintenance funding isn't immediately spent, all of it. So there's money that we would have, from this budget, we would expect to be spent later on. It won't be spent, not on that, at least, if the troops aren't there yet. The money in this account is fungible, right? So we see in operation and maintenance, there's very little detail as to what goes on inside of these broad accounts. I was just looking at enterprise integration, I think it was, Navy base support, got more money this year than requested.
Right.
Well, what is that? Well, that's a huge number of programs.
Yeah. They have a summer barbecue, too.
Yeah, well, they can move from one, they can move money from, the whole point is they can move money from one project to another.
Right.
And that sort of flexibility, particularly in this OCO money, if there is no mission to support, gives them the opportunity to say, hey, we've got a bunch of helicopters that need fixing. Use some of the reprogramming authority, which is provided in there, to move not just within the account where they have flexibility, but between accounts where they would want more flexibility. So this is, as Rob said, not really a slush fund.
Sure.
But because it may very well be needed for a specific purpose requested. But if it is not, they have some authority to be able to switch that money. Some contractors would win, some would lose.
Speaking of contractors that would win, Congress did say that we've got some people here that could probably benefit from some of this money. Looking at the new tanker aircraft, the KC-46 made by Boeing, McConnell Air Force in Kansas got $219 million, and Altus Air Force Base in Oklahoma got $30.9 million to prepare for this future tanker, the KC-46. Meanwhile, the F-35, something that's obviously a big behemoth that has not really done or lived up to the expectations, could be Windows 98, could be Windows XP that's causing the computer problems, I don't know. But this KC-46 has basically gotten the green light from Congress. Meanwhile, the F-35, they're saying, we don't trust you anymore. It's, from the outside, that's how it appears to me. Rob, is that...
Yeah, well, I think that's a little bit... you got to understand... The KC-46, you know, that money, that decision was made a few years ago, and that program
is on track. As was the
F-35,
however.
What's that?
It's the F-35 decision was made years ago, too.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is the KC-46, they're getting, you know, ready to actually bring this aircraft operationally, and they had set aside money already in the budget for basically building up the bases and putting the infrastructure on the bases necessary to support the aircraft. What happened here is they simply now had, the Air Force had made the decision about where that money was going to go. They made a basing decision.
Right.
They knew they were going to have to base the aircraft somewhere. They set aside money in the military construction budget to build the facilities necessary. They just hadn't decided which bases. Now they've decided which bases. So the money was in the president's request originally, and now because the Air Force has made the decision, they can simply say, okay, this is where the money is going to go. But this tanker, you have to understand, is the KC-46 is replacing the KC-135, which is a very old aircraft. Many of those aircraft are older than the pilots that fly them. And so the KC-46 is a very high-priority program. They're not going to cut the numbers. In fact, the whole buy only replaces one-third of the KC-135 fleet. They've still got to buy, you know, two more sets, either this tanker or some other tanker, to fully, replace that that aircraft. And the first of those flew in, like, the late 1950s.
Yeah. And I'll say that I got three words for you.
All right.
Fixed-price contract. The KC-46 is under a fixed-price contract with Boeing. Everyone suspects that Boeing, at least on the initial engineering and aircraft, is taking a loss. That is done to keep out competition,
sure.
But also to shore up, as Rob said, in future programs. And so that would be a key difference in how Congress treats the KC-46A program versus the Lockheed Martin F-35, is that the cost growth from the KC-46 is not the problem of the Pentagon. And that, so the Congress likes this. Congress, and so if you look in the budget, you see the amount of money that they've requested, they got exactly that amount of money. That's a program,
sure.
Which is one of those programs which is not touched.
It's a bargain.
Well, I don't know if it's a bargain. although you get a good sense that many in the Pentagon think it is a bargain.
Sure.
It's not entirely clear, but it meets a critical need. They've got it at the price they want.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, where Dr. Kevin Brancato and Robert Levinson, both senior defense analysts with BGov, are reviewing Congress resizes reign with $30 billion defense cut. It's a BGov insight, and obviously it's apparent the omnibus will make it through, likely later this week. What's next for this? What's on the horizon for this defense money? Are we going to be finding more secret accounts elsewhere, Rob, where money's going to be shifted to and from? Is this over, or is this just the beginning?
Well, Alan, this is really the beginning of a long process. What we're going to see now is, you know, is less than a month now, although it may be delayed, the president's supposed to give his request for the 2015 budget. Now, the difference here is the 2014 budget and the 2013 budget that the president submitted were not in line with the Budget Control Act. And so, you know, either that law was going to have to change or massive cuts, which we have seen in both 13 and 14, were going to have to happen to DOD. This time, everybody fully expects the president will submit a budget that's in compliance basically with that Ryan-Marie agreement, which is significantly lower than what it had been projected. But at least this time, the Pentagon is going to really have to do its own prioritization. In other words, it can't leave it up to Congress. I mean, it could, but that would be foolish. They now have the opportunity to, you know, build a budget within those numbers that are required by the law. And then Congress will still tinker with that budget, as it always does, but probably not to the degree we saw here, because you don't have to make these massive cuts. In other words, the Pentagon's going to submit a budget which already has those cuts built in and says, here's where we'd like to take them. And then Congress can deal with that. So 2015 is really the Pentagon finally coming to grips with these lower budgetary resources and deciding, look, we have to be realistic about the money that we're going to get. The military is going to be different going forward. We've got less money. Let's start making some hard choices.
Okay. Yeah, I think we've said that the Pentagon said that they are probably going to try to maintain their technological dominance going out into the future. So you see, it's not really reflected in the fiscal 14. There are cuts across the board. There's no drastic, huge decrease. We got an inkling that the Pentagon would want to bump up the research and development accounts to ensure the future technological superiority of the U.S. military, but you don't really see that here. You see a bunch of programs that do get more money, so you maybe have an inkling of what's going on, but you don't have this broad-based rebudgeting for the future. We hope we will see this. Defense contractors especially hope that we will see this, because they need to know where they should put their investments. You know, there was a news report last week that the Navy's going to cut back its littoral combat ship buy to 32 from 52. Yeah, well, I mean, that's consistent with their current contracting strategy. Basically, when the current contracts run out, they don't have any money to budget for any more of that. That's how they're going to deal with some of that. But that is not indicative of how many ships should the Navy have. Where do they need them? What size should they be?
Right.
You don't have that sense yet. What you have are very individual decisions. It is very difficult to pull back and say, okay, here's the new strategy. Well, we'll see this. Okay, a few fewer F-35s, because that's what they've done with the budget deal. These fewer ships. Some programs, very few programs in this budget were terminated, right? Usually it's the Pentagon's going to say, oh, we want to cut this program. You should see a much more widespread programs being terminated. And there were only very tiny changes in this appropriations law that give you the type of prioritization we think is probably going to come.
You know what I see here? I see this as, and it just struck me a second ago, as we're discussing the decisions that were made, and we kind of alluded to it earlier with the how many of the these decisions were actually politically motivated. I see midterm election posturing.
I think that the reason that the budget deal had fiscal 15 agreement, mm-hmm. as well as fiscal 14 agreement, is that it takes it off the table as far as discussion goes.
Right.
So now, at least on the defense side, there is no more discussion about what the top line budget is for 15.
Right.
Before the next election.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, I would agree that. So, I would go this far, but I'm not sure Rob would. But it would be considered a.
I'll stick my neck out for Rob.
No, it's just the look. It protects incumbents of both parties.
Sure.
Against the wrangling, if folks and voters don't like the endless wrangling, this is just one less issue to debate
sure.
over.
But this is a big issue that they don't have to worry about now. This is something that is off the table come midterm.
Yeah. Well, and the other good thing is from a national security's perspective is. You know, I've been telling people now since the passage of the Budget Control Act, which was, you know, in the summer of 2011, we have not been having a discussion about what the appropriate amount of money and the appropriate way to spend it for national security is. We've been having a discussion about a budget and getting to a budget number, and it's been the national security discussion has been totally subsumed underneath a discussion about taxes and about revenue and about spending.
Right.
Thankfully, for people who pay attention to national security, we've sort of ended that discussion. We're not talking about the top line. And now we can have a real discussion and debate about what is the appropriate path for the U.S. military going forward, as Kevin mentioned. What does that more advanced technological force mean? Where do we place our bets? What does it mean for benefits? You know, there were some cuts to military retirement in this budget for the first time in a long time. So now people can wrestle with these really hard decisions and have a real national security discussion instead of, you know, just getting it wrapped up into a larger budgetary discussion, which is important, but that's not how you're supposed to be making national security decisions.
Agreed.
Yeah, I would say a lot of the visibility that we have into how the Pentagon works is through its budget.
Right.
And so if we don't have a good set, its own budget request, not even the Congress, its own budget request, because it gives you a long-range plan. And so we'll get a much better sense for stuff that it's developing, stuff that it procures, the big weapon systems. What we won't get a good sense of, though, I think, are some of the investments like cybersecurity. Those, a lot of it, not all of it, is not funded out of research and development and procurement, where we've got really good detail, but operation and maintenance. And operation and maintenance is much higher level. They don't provide a five-year plan. So there are some key changes going into the future that are still going to be clouded, even when we get that request. And so it gives ample room for Rob and me just to continue talking to you about these things.
More dissection to follow, I'm sure. Guys, this has been really eye-opening, and I appreciate that you've written it, and you can find it on Bloomberg Government. It's called Congress Seizes Reins with $30 billion Defense Cuts, $30 billion in defense cuts. It's a BGov Insight. His name is Dr. Kevin Brancato. On the phone is Robert Levinson. Gentlemen, thank you for being here.
My pleasure, Alan.
Mine too.